5.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we continue Francis Stoner Saunders' book, The Woman Who Shot Mussolini, which tells the story of Violet Gibson, the daughter of an Anglo-Irish peer, who in April 1926 fired a revolver at the fascist leader. Despite the close quarters, the bullet merely grazed his nose. In the immediate aftermath, Violet was set upon by the crowd and then arrested and taken to prison. The reader is Sinead Cusack.
Violet slept soundly through her first night in prison, in contrast to Chief Superintendent Panetta, who hadn't slept at all. By the time he arrived at the prison, the Mantellati, at 8 a.m., his old tutor, Professor Ottolenghi, a famed specialist in criminal medicine, was waiting to examine her. The encounter lasted 2 hours, after which Ottolenghi reported that she could either be feigning madness or she could indeed be mad. Violet was taken back to her cell, where she now met the Crown Prosecutor and the examining magistrate. At first, their questions yielded nothing. Violet was mute, her features carefully locked, her tired and austere face relieved occasionally by a secret smile. They persisted. "Are you, or have you ever been mentally ill?" She stared past them. Then, after a long silence, repeated what she had told them in her first interview. Something about having tried to commit suicide the previous year, that her family had tried to have her return to England, that she didn't want to go because she knew they wanted to put her into a lunatic asylum. "Why did you shoot Mussolini?" Silence. Then, as if stirred by her own thoughts, she spoke. Yes, she now remembered why she shot Mussolini. It was to glorify God, because God's message in such matters was clear. And in addition, he had sent an angel to steady her as she took aim.
Who were her accomplices?
She had been counseled by the wisest men who ever lived, but they were now dead. She had a special ability to communicate with the dead. Her room in the convent had become a meeting place of the spiritual elect and famous men, and they were all her accomplices.
Where had she got the gun?
The answer to this was more mundane. A friend had left it to her on his death, and she had brought it with her from England. After an hour of this, the magistrates concluded that owing to her mental infirmity, it would be difficult to try her. But the prosecutor nominated a defence counsel for Violet as required by law. Constance arrived in Rome by night train from Paris on the 11th of April. She was met by Andrea Serrao, legal counsel for the British Embassy, and a dozen plainclothes policemen provided for her own safety. They proceeded directly to the embassy, where the news was not encouraging. Violet might indeed be tried, regardless of her mental state. Nobody would be granted access to her until the preliminary investigation was completed, and who knew when that would be. The family, Serrao insisted, needed to hire the best lawyer at whatever price. The British ambassador, Sir Ronald Graham, had further bad news, that there wasn't a single hotel in Rome that would accept a booking in the name of Gibson. The most highly regarded criminologist in Rome at that time was Enrico Ferri, and Serrao accompanied Constance to his offices, tall, patriarchal, sporting a spectacular moustache and a neatly trimmed pharaoh's beard. Ferri was professor of criminology at the University of Rome. Ferri told Constance his price for defending Violet would be £1,000, about £41,000 today, a huge sum, but Constance immediately acquiesced. Constance was told to write up all the facts relevant to a defence of Violet as insane. This she did on the evening of the 11th of April at the Hotel dei Principi, where a room had finally been obtained for her under an assumed name. She paid off Violet's outstanding bills and left Rome 36 hours after arriving on the 10:45 p.m. train, tailed by undercover police officers as far as the border at Como Chiasso. She booked into the Park Hotel in Lausanne and waited. There was nothing to do now but sit it out by the lake. She stayed in Switzerland to the end of July. The wait gave the family plenty of time to ponder what to do with Violet. The Gibson plan was internment for life. In Chief Superintendent Panetta's first report, he emphasized the possibility that Gibson was an intelligent and sly fanatic, eccentric and neurotic maybe, but not mad, and that she had not acted alone, but more probably she was part of a group of unidentified conspirators who had devised a careful plan to assassinate Mussolini. Violet's notebook should have been the key to any sensitive forensic search for her motive. Panetta sought a pattern to link up bits of her life. He found only the weird, the troubling, the difficulty in making sense of someone who was trying to make sense of herself. But there was a pattern. A pattern not of incident, but of meaning. The notebook reveals Violet's true self, full of internal contradictions, existential incoherence, but no less authentic for that. It is not possible to understand Violet's story without acknowledging the need to embrace contradictory evidence. Thus, by any definition, Violet must be considered mad, at least some of the time. But this does not mean that the whole of her life should be rewritten to fit this conclusion. Writing to Enid Dinis some months after the attack, Violet reflected on her experience at Campidoglio. "My clothes were torn to pieces and my holy medals ripped from me. But inside, I was transported to another place that had nothing to do with politics. And without any effort on my part, my heart was filled with sweetness and great love." Mussolini's own view, as expressed to Graham on his return from Libya, was that Violet was mad and that he was bored with the whole affair. Graham reported the meeting in detail to the Foreign Secretary, Austen Chamberlain. "I asked His Excellency whether anything further had transpired regarding Miss Gibson. He replied that from the outset the whole affair had been of scant interest to him and that he had not been following its developments. It appeared evident that Miss Gibson was stark, staring mad, and he hoped that before long she would be sent back to her native Ireland, where, according to his information regarding the inhabitants, she would find plenty of congenial company. Il Duce may have been bored, but there was due process to be followed. On Friday, the 6th of May, 1927, the investigating commission of the Special Tribunal finally assembled, in camera, to consider Violet's case. She was spared the full spectacle of open court and the cage. At Enrico Ferri's instructions, she was not present at all. The last thing her defense lawyer wanted was for her to compromise his arguments by appearing normal. In court, Ferri argued that Mussolini's distinguished political career was due to his exceptional temperament, associated with a particular anthropological type. He was a man of action, similar in physical stature to Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Cavour, Garibaldi, and Lenin. He even possessed the Napoleonic face, characterized by a broad, prominent forehead and a square lower jaw. This was a particular kind of jaw, no longer solely connected with its assigned biological function, but signifying the supremacy of the will. Ferri went on to propose that Mussolini had survived Violet's attempt because at the moment she fired, he had affected the mystic gesture of lifting his head towards the sky at the sound of the fascist hymn Giovinezza. This was consonant with the man of genius, who acted like an electric accumulator, gathering the diffuse electricity present in the atmosphere, which would otherwise remain sterile, vague, and elusive. The transformed energy would then fly off in a spark of light in a shock of locomotive force. It was as if Mussolini possessed the power to turn back the bullet. Stripped of its mythologies and textual curlicues, Ferry's narrative implies a far more startling possibility, that the diagnosis conferred on Violet Gibson could just as well apply to Benito Mussolini. Violet's psychiatric profile underscored her well-developed intelligence, intransigence, solitariness, dissimulation, fanaticism, suspiciousness, and intolerance. It stressed her refusal to listen to the advice of others, her capacity to hurt people without showing remorse, and her megalomania, the belief that she was carrying out a divinely ordained mission. All proof, the psychiatrists claimed, of a serious form of mental alienation. At the special tribunal, Enrico Ferri concluded his presentation with an outright deception. The accused, he acknowledged, must be considered as a dangerous subject and in consequence should be deprived of her personal liberty. He went on to state that Miss Gibson herself is quite persuaded as to the correctness of the above deductions. She acknowledges that she should be confined permanently in an asylum, i.e. for an absolutely unlimited period, and that she has agreed that such a decision would meet her case perfectly. Ferry had not told his client of this decision, nor had she acquiesced to her permanent internment in a madhouse. Emerging after a short while to issue their decision, the tribunal's judgment was that Violet was a danger to herself and to others. The tribunal's president ordered Violet to be handed over to the police authorities and then confined to an asylum. Violet was at the Villa Giuseppina during the hearing, and there she stayed. 2 days later, she was told she had a visitor. It was Constance, come to her sister directly from the train that carried her and her expeditionary force. A police official called at the British Embassy on Wednesday, the 11th of May, to confirm that Violet's expulsion from Italian territory had been authorised and that she should be removed forthwith. Violet reacted calmly to the news of her release, still ignorant of Ferry's lie, that she had acquiesced in his diagnosis and agreed to her own indefinite internment in an asylum. To her, it seemed simply that justice had finally been done. Her mood was serene when, together with Constance, she gathered and packed her personal effects. Constance, fraught with anxiety about any last-minute hitches, and noticing that her sister showed no particular curiosity about what plans had been made for her, told her nothing. Shortly before departing, Violet asked to be allowed to write a letter. It was addressed to the Mother Superior of the Mantellati prison. "Dear Mother Superior, I feel obliged to write you these lines to thank you for the kind consideration you showed towards me when I was in prison. You were so careful in the choice of the guards assigned to watch over me, and in allowing me on occasion to take some air and go to Mass. Please be so kind as to offer my thanks also to the director. Remember me to all the nuns." The Honourable Violet Gibson had not forgotten her manners.
Sinead Cusack was reading from The Woman Who Shot Mussolini by Frances Stoner Saunders. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production.
On BBC Radio 4, the Oscar-winning producer David Putnam in the BBC Sound Archive.
"To have taken what is absolutely a Cinderella picture and awarded it this, you come to see it in droves, is absolutely extraordinary."
Hearing that clip now, David, does it still give you goosebumps?
He tells John Wilson about receiving the Academy Award for Chariots of Fire.
"The funniest thing was, there's a sort of velvet cover on the top of the podium and it's crooked."
"So you made it your job to straighten it up?"
"Straightened the velvet and got on with the speech."
David Putnam, Meeting Myself Coming Back, on Saturday evening at 8 on BBC Radio 4.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is Luke Tudden.